Ave Maria, and welcome to Divine Poetry, a series that explores the chronological parallels between the history of the Catholic Church and the Old Testament. If you're new to this concept, go back and watch my interview with Kevin Davis. The link is in the video description below. To make things more simple, I have divided up church history and the Old Testament into 8 color-coded time periods. Below, you can see a scrolling bar with the names, dates, and the Old Testament books for each period. Use this timeline to guide you in each video. The color frame of each video will match the time period that we're discussing. Now, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Episode 7 of Divine Poetry. Today, I would like to present the parallels between Ruth and Boaz in the Old Testament and Clovis and St. Clotilda in church history. But in order to be able to do that in a convincing way, I think, I first also have to establish the time period in which the story of Ruth and Boaz took place, and that's the time period of the Judges. And then by comparison, by parallel, by foreshadowing, I need to also establish that time in church history that would relate to that, and that is the time of the Church Fathers. Before we start, I want to announce that my book is on track to be released Easter Monday. If you want to order again from me personally, you can go to the website and you can either pre-order and pay right away, or you can just sign up for a copy and then I'll email you when the books become available. But again, it'll be Easter Monday is when I'll be able to start shipping them out. If you do order from me, I'll be able to include a brochure, a free brochure with the history of the church and the history of the Old Testament paralleled in a very graphic and easy to understand way. Okay, I think that covers it. So let's start. Okay, so the Book of Ruth states at the very beginning that in the days of one of the judges, when the judges ruled, there came a famine in the land. And that's the start of the Book of Ruth. So we're told right from the start that the story of Ruth is nested inside the period of the judges. And then the corresponding story of St. Clotilda and Clovis and their marriage and his conversion takes place during the time period of the Church Fathers, which is generally thought to have started sometime in the second century. I think St. Ignatius of Antioch is considered the very first Church Father. And then that period continues on until the 700s AD, when it's generally accepted that that would be the end of the period. There's no definitive date. In fact, Church Fathers it's a title applied to great saints and great teachers of the faith during this time period, but there was no office to fill. There was no election to be had. They just simply were called a Church Father because of the greatness of their teaching and the holiness of their lives. Similarly, the judges in the Old Testament weren't a title, wasn't a title that was given to them or appointed to them by anyone of any official capacity. It just was that they rose to prominence through their love of the God of Israel, and also their ability to defend the Israelites. And so people rallied around them, much like they did with the Church Fathers. All right, in the Book of Judges, it mentions twice that this. It says, in those days, there was no king in Israel, but everyone did that which seemed right to himself. That's a theme that's woven into the Book of the Judges. Now, it says that there was no king in Israel yet because King Saul had not yet been anointed. The period of the Judges takes place between the Egyptian slavery time period, which ended when Moses freed the Israelites from slavery, their entrance into the Promised Land. And so then the Book of Judges starts off after they get into the Promised Land. And then it ends about when King Saul is crowned or anointed the first king. So that would be the interim period between the king and the Egyptian slavery period. The interim period is loosely called the period of the Judges. In church history, you have a very similar situation where after the Roman persecution is over, that loosely starts the period of the Church Fathers. Now, you will have some Church Fathers who are actually considered Church Fathers, but they existed inside the persecution period. But also, Moses was considered to be the very first judge. So there is a little bit of an overlap, but it also happens in both the New and the Old as well. Okay, without getting into too much detail, I just want to assert right here, and I'll have to back it up in some other video because I can't get into all these things in one video, that the equivalent of King Saul in church history is the Byzantine Empire, as far as I can tell. So therefore, the period of the Church Fathers is that loose time period between the end of the Roman persecution of Christians and the rise of the Byzantine Empire as a Catholic, a defense of the Catholic Church. Just as Saul defended Israel, and he got anointed by Samuel, so too around the 500s, I believe, or maybe around the 600s, I think 500s, is when the Byzantine Empire started to accept their crowns from the church, from the Patriarch of Constantinople, thus acting like a King Saul kind of a person. Okay, hopefully that makes sense. So like I said before, the book of the Judges states twice that that in those days there was no king in Israel, but everyone did that which seemed right to himself. So it was a little bit like the Wild West, I like to say, because you had the people of Israel, like it says, is doing what they thought was best. Okay, in church history, you have a similar situation in that doctrine was not yet firmly established yet. If you recall, when Christianity became legal, you had the very first church council. Well, the Council of Jerusalem happened in like 59 AD, but I should say after the persecution of Christians, the very first church council after that was the Council of Nicaea in 325, and it started to establish doctrine. So this is where you have the Nicene Creed coming, and you can see that in order to combat these heresies, councils are being called and doctrines being established. So we can say, therefore, that in those days, meaning the days of the Church Fathers, there was no defined doctrine in the church, but every bishop taught which seemed right to himself. And that therein lies the problem with all these heresies. Because there was no doctrine yet established, Arius asserted that Christ was not God. Or because doctrine was not established, Nestorius asserted that, what did he say, that Our Lady was not the mother of God, but he also, well, I don't want to get it wrong, but anyway, his heresies, okay? And they're all Christological in nature. So these bishops, again, are just teaching what they thought was best, and it turned out to be a heresy, okay? And so there's an interesting parallel there. They both have a very cyclical nature. The books of the Judges, the pattern is really this. In fact, I can show you the pattern by reading you a text from the books of the Judges. Let me read this to you. This is from, I'll put the quote on the screen. And he, meaning God, left them, that he might try Israel by them, whether they should hear the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses, or not. So the children of Israel dwelt in the midst of the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And they took their daughters to wives, which was contrary to their law. They couldn't take foreign pagan wives. And they gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. And they did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they forgot their God and served Balaam and Astaroth. And the Lord, being angry with Israel, delivered them into the hands of the Rathathaim, king of Mesopotamia, and they served him for 8 years. And they cried to the Lord, who raised them up a savior, and delivered them, to wit, Othoniel, the son of Senez, the younger brother of Caleb. And the spirit of the Lord was in him, and he judged Israel. And he went out to fight, and the Lord delivered into his hands Cusum Rathathaim, king of Syria, and he overthrew him. So there it is that the Israelites were unfaithful to God. They followed pagan gods, and therefore God delivered them up to an oppressor who for a time oppressed them, and then a judge came along, saved them from their oppression, and freed them. And then a couple of verses later, though, it mentions this. And the land rested for 40 years, and Othoniel, the son of Senez, died. And here's the key part. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, who strengthened against them Eglon, king of Moab, because they did evil in his sight. So, and then God would call up another judge. So there's a cycle that happens throughout the book of the Judges. This happens over and over again. The Israelites worship a pagan god. They are oppressed. They're delivered. And they do it again and again. Now contrast that same cyclical nature of the time of the Judges with the cyclical nature of the time of the Church Fathers, where a heresy would arise. Many Catholics, Catholic Christians at that time, believed the heresy, which is akin to believing and following a false god, right? Because what you're doing is those heresies were establishing a false Christ, that they would worship a false Christ, who is a false god. It's not the real Christ, not the true God. So they're worshiping false Christs through these heresies. And it's cyclical. First Arianism would arise, and then the Council of Nicaea would be convened. It condemned Arianism. And then the church fathers would come up and speak and preach against Arianism, like St. Athanasius and I think St. Augustine as well. And then Pelagianism would arise, and the same cycle would happen over. Then the Council of Carthage would be called in 418 and condemned Pelagianism. Then Nestorianism would arise, and Christians would believe that, and that would be condemned. So and then on and on the cycle goes, all throughout the period of the Church Fathers. Similarly, the Church Fathers, they would arise at different times and places throughout that time period. Some of them would be in the West, like St. Augustine of Hippo, Pope St. Leo the Great. And then some would be in the East, St. Basil, St. Cyril, St. Athanasius. That is comparable to the judges who would arise at different times throughout that period, some minor, some major judges. For instance, Othniel defeated the Mesopotamians, Ao defeated the Moabites, Samgar the Philistines, Deborah, Sisera, Gideon would defeat the Midianites, and so on, just like these church fathers would defeat different heresies in different locations. You know, sometimes the heresy was stronger in the north and weaker in the south, just like how these enemy tribes would not oppress the whole nation of Israel at the same time, just portions of it. So really, it's phenomenal, the amount of parallels here between them. And I like that in church history, it's primarily the enemies of the faith. In the Old Testament, they're physical enemies. Not to say, though, that in church history, the church also did have enemy tribes as well. So just as the Midianites and the Amorites, the Philistines, they all would oppress at different times, so too were there tribes like the Vandals, the Lombards, the Bulgars, the Ostrogoths, who acted as oppressors to the church in the West, particularly, just like those tribes did. And, you know, remember how Gideon, he was one of the judges, and how he was told by God to go and fight the Midianites with like 300 and some men, thus miraculously defending Israel. Who against the Midianites, I think it was. Well, it doesn't matter. I think it was the Midianites. And there was scads and scads of them. But Gideon was able to miraculously kind of scare them away through a ruse that God commanded him to do. Compare that story, though, to the story of Pope St. Leo the Great, who went out to meet Attila the Hun and somehow managed to turn Attila away. Attila had a vast army. And Pope St. Gregory the Great had himself and some companions. I think the story goes that St. Peter and St. Paul appeared beside him, and something was said or something was done, but Attila decided to turn around. So again, we also have physical tribes persecuting the church, just as those physical tribes persecuted Israel in the time of the judges. Okay, so establishing those connections between the judges and the church fathers, nested inside of the Old Testament story of the judges is the story of Ruth. And I think I read that passage where the very first line of the book of Ruth says that it was in the days of the judges. Okay. So if you remember, Ruth was a Moabite and she converted to the God of Israel. She became a believer of the Israelite God and his laws and commandments. Let's see if I can quote something here. I think so. Okay. This is Ruth quoting, I'm quoting Ruth now, talking to her mother-in-law, Naomi, who's returning to Bethlehem, and Ruth wants to go with her. So, and she answered, "Be not against me to desire that I should leave thee and depart, for whithersoever thou shalt go, I will go, and where thou shalt dwell, I also will dwell. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. The land that shall receive thee dying is the same will I die, and there will I be buried." Okay, so here you have Ruth proclaiming that she wants to follow Naomi and be of the land and of the same God, of the same religion as her. So that's her conversion. If you remember, though, Ruth then would go on to marry Boaz, who was a powerful landlord or landowner, and their union produced a son. So let me read this passage about who their son is. This is significant. "And Naomi, who is Ruth's mother-in-law, taking the child, laid it in her bosom, and she carried it and was a nurse unto it. And the women, her neighbors, congratulating with her and saying, there is a son born in Naomi." Now it's Ruth's son, but because Naomi adopted Ruth, she's acting like the grandmother, right? So there's a son born to Naomi, called his name Obed. He is the father of Isai, with Jesse, the father of David. So because of Ruth's conversion to the God of Israel, she became the ancestor of King David, who was the central king in the Old Testament. From David came the whole dynasty of kings that ruled Israel all the way up in time until the Babylonian captivity. A very significant time. David is maybe the most central figure in the Old Testament, maybe Moses. It's very close, though. Okay, so we have now in church history, let's go to Ruth and Boaz, right? So in the time of the barbarians, and this is around the 500s, a very early 500s, the Roman Empire just fell in 476. And now the church, particularly the Holy See, really has no protector. And it's like a Wild West now. It's like a time of the judges. And you have all these different tribes. The Lombards are ruling over Italy, and they're oppressing the church. Pope St. Gregory the Great, from what I understand, had to pay bribe money so they wouldn't attack Rome. The Ostrogoths were also a problem. The Franks were either Aryan or pagan, and they were the largest tribe in Western Europe. So Clovis, his wife died, he's the king of the Franks, and he wanted to make an alliance with a small tribe called the Burgundians. So he proposed to marry a princess of the Burgundian tribe, St. Clotilda, who just happened to be Catholic. Her family, I don't think, was Catholic. I think her dad was an Arian, but she was a Catholic. Somehow a missionary reached her. She professed faith in the faith of the church. So when she married Clovis, she went to the realm of the Franks, being the only Catholic in the whole realm, just like how Ruth was the only Moabite amongst the Israelites. She was a foreigner in that land, just like Ruth was. But instead of, in the Old Testament, it was the woman, Ruth, who converted, but in church history, it's Clovis who converts. Because as we know, Clovis received baptism. He accepted baptism. I think it was in 509, don't quote me, 501, 509 AD, baptized by St. Remigius. And upon his baptism, the whole tribe of the Franks eventually, if not, I don't think immediately, but very soon after, also became Catholic. So now you had a very powerful barbarian tribe who were Catholic and who were obedient to the papacy. They weren't hostile to the papacy like the Lombards were, which is a great benefit to the church. Now, let me read this. This is significant. Okay, his baptism I'm reading right now is in 508. So historians have said that it was the conversion of Clovis that paved the way for the future rise of Charlemagne. Charlemagne is a King David figure in church history. Charlemagne starts the Holy Roman Empire, which ruled over Europe all the way until Napoleon, who is a parallel with the Babylonian captivity in the Old Testament. So even the time period of this great long-lasting dynasty is paralleled, King David's and Charlemagne's. Charlemagne is the second empire protector of Christendom. Remember, the Byzantines were the first, but they displeased God by disobeying the Pope. So the Pope crowned another one, Charlemagne, just like how Samuel anointed Saul, who did not obey the word of the Lord. So he went to anoint David instead. So David and Charlemagne are the same, paralleling, and King Saul and the Byzantines likewise are paralleling. I did mention this just a little bit ago, but let me reemphasize this, is that it was Clovis's conversion that paved the way for Charlemagne, just like how it was Ruth's conversion that led to the birth of King David. Let me read to you from an article that highlights this. Clovis is also important or significant because of his baptism in 508, I got the wrong date, largely at the behest of his wife, St. Clotilda, who would later be venerated as a saint for this act. Celebrated today in both the church, the Catholic Church, and the Eastern heretic sect, which I won't say, they're not Orthodox. Anyway, the adoption of Clovis, by Clovis of Nicene Christianity, as opposed to Arianism, led to widespread conversion among the Frankish peoples, to religious unification across what is now modern-day France, the Low Countries, and Germany. 3 centuries later, it led to Charlemagne's alliance with the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. And in the middle of the 10th century, under Otto the Great, the consequential birth of the Holy Roman Empire. So you have here the admission that Clovis's conversion led to the eventual rise of Charlemagne, which, as I'm saying, is similar to Ruth's conversion leading to King David. Okay, last point I want to make, I'm not doing that bad on this video, is another aspect of the Book of Ruth, which deals with the law of inheritance. There is a theme running through the Book of Ruth about who's going to inherit this field and how it gets passed down into whom. There's in the Old Testament, if your if your husband died, let's say a husband had a wife, and if the husband died, it's the brothers of the husband or their nearest kin, male kin, had the obligation to marry the wife to produce offspring for her so that his brother's line does not go extinct. So you have, that's what's happening here with the story of Ruth, because Naomi's husband died first. Naomi's two sons each married these two Moabite women. One was Ruth. And then both of Naomi's sons died, right? That's why Ruth returned with Naomi back to Bethlehem. So you have two widows. You have Naomi and Ruth, both widows. So Boaz turns out to be one of the kin, the closest kin of Naomi. And so he, therefore, can marry Ruth, and he also can buy a field by doing that. And I'm going to get into that in a second. So in church history, you have the rise of Salic law, which was instituted by Clovis. And guess what Salic law had to do with? It had to do with the inheritance only of men of property in European history. First, let me read you the passage from Ruth, and I'll try to explain it a little more. And Booth and Boaz, or Bo, I don't know how you pronounce that, Boaz, taking 10 men of the ancients of the city, said to them, "Sit ye down here." They sat down, and he spoke to the kinsmen. Naomi, who has returned from the country of Moab, will sell a parcel of land that belonged to her brother Elimelech. I would have thee to understand this, and would tell thee before all that sit here, and before the ancients of my people, if thou wilt take possession of it by the right of kindred, buy it and possess it. But if it please thee not, tell me so, that I may know what I have to do. For there is no nearer kinsman besides thee, who art first, and me, who am second. So Boaz is a second related to Naomi. This other fella is the first. And he's asking the first fella, do you want this land? Right? And here he's going to spring the trap on him now. He says, I will, the other fella says, I will buy the field. And Boaz said to him, when thou shalt buy the field at the woman's hand, thou shalt take also Ruth the Moabitess, who was the wife of the deceased, to raise up the name of thy kinsman in his inheritance. All right. And he answered, I yield up my right to the next of kin, for I must not cut off the posterity of my own family. Do thou make use of my privilege, which I profess I do willingly forego. So Boaz there is saying that to this other nearer kinsman to him, he's second degree, this other person's first degree, if you want this field, you have to marry Ruth. And the man says, oh, no, I can't marry Ruth because I already have sons, and I don't want to dilute their inheritance by having more sons born to me that I have to split their inheritance among more people. So he says, I better not do that. I just want to keep the inheritance I have for my sons the way it is. Okay, Salic law now. I'm going to read now from Salic law. Salic law, also known as Salian law, was the ancient Frankish civil law code compiled about around 500 AD by the Frankish king Clovis. The written text is in Latin and contains some of the earliest known instances of Old Dutch. It remains the basis of Frankish law throughout the early medieval period and influenced future European legal systems. The best known tenet of the old law is the principle of exclusion of women from the inheritance of thrones, fiefs, and other properties. Salic law regulates succession according to sex. Agnatic succession means succession to the throne of fief going to an agnate of the predecessor, for example, a brother, a son, or a nearest male relative through the male line. It's astonishing the amount of points of contact between the law and the Book of Ruth and the Salic law. First, you have this agnetic succession, which talks about the next closest male line of kin, and that's exactly what Boaz was talking about in the passage I read. You have the inheritance of the land by women. In Salic law, you were not allowed to do that. It can only get passed down through the men. And here you have the fact that there's this field that's connected to Ruth. And if you want the field, you have to marry the woman. So there's this connection between the land and the woman and the inheritance and male-only possession of the land. It's really fascinating. I'm not articulating very well, I think, the clear parallels, but I think they're evident without me having to articulate them. Anyway, so there you go. You have Ruth and Boaz and Clovis and St. Clotilda both setting up the stage for the great dynastic kingdom that follows. And in future videos, I'll talk about the King David parallels with Charlemagne. They're fascinating. Have a fantastic Holy Week, everyone, and God bless you. Glory be to God. Ave Maria.